Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is poet Tony Glegler, and we're going to be talking about his collection, Until the Last Light Leaves. Tony, welcome back to the show. I love talking to you, so I'm so glad to be interviewing you again.
No, same here. I had a good time, despite my nervousness.
or because of it. You never know.
Right.
One of the things I noticed, and I want to talk about this, you're what I would call a prolific poet. Would you say that?
Not really.
But you have like five collections of your poems published. Or is that not a big thing in poetry?
Well, I think it's a big thing because I'm not sure I was ever going to get any. But
so one would be good.
Yes. A lot of people I talk to or I'm friends with, I think, write more poems than me. I kind of use a lot of baseball metaphors.
Yeah.
I like to believe I have a really good slugging percentage.
Because anybody can write a lot of poems, if you know what I mean. It's writing good poems that's the hard thing. That's always been my complaint about poets that I know. And it's things that you can't talk about to them. That their poetry is not that good. And you can never say that to anybody. I mean, do you say that to anybody?
The people I exchange work with regularly.
Yeah.
That we can be critical of each other.
Okay.
You know, I can say to a couple of people, oh, that really sucks. Or I can say, that's not one of my favorites. And, you know, there are other times, oh, I love this one.
I think that's really important. It's like in all art forms, you know, you need criticism that you can count on. You know, if everybody's just sort of glad-handing you and you know, giving you sort of false praise, like we all win a medal in this one, what good is it? And it's not going to improve you as a poet, right?
No, that's how I feel. And, you know, that's what I found from the people that I've decided to exchange stuff with.
But what about the poets that you don't exchange things with? You can't say that to them, right?
No, I wouldn't think of it.
You'll think of it.
I would think of it, but I wouldn't say it.
And I want to say this right out loud for the benefit of the audience. The reason I can talk like this is that I really enjoy your poetry. And one of the things I noticed by reading the second collection, which came before What Kind of Man, and you talked to me about this off mic. Your poetry is like your diary. Like if you were to, I imagine if you were to line up all your books chronologically and I were to read them, it would be like peeking into your diary.
Yeah, I think so. I don't have a great imagination, so I'm going on these little things that happen in my life and things that are important to me.
Yeah, but I find that really powerful poetry. You don't want to get Byronic and start, you know, wafting high and mighty about things, because that's really easy to just sort of lose sight of things. It's amazing to me to read your poetry about your life working in the home for the developing disabled, because, and I mentioned this last time, and now after reading this collection, it's really true. I really feel like I know these people, or I know an aspect of them. I shouldn't say I know these people. I mean the people who are the residents of this home, you're quite frank about how you talk about them, but it's done out of a lot of care and love.
No, I do think my poems do a pretty good job of trying to present people as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I do care about these guys a great deal. Definitely, you know, love them on a deep level. But, you know, I really do treat them as if, you know, they're my friends or my younger brother or my son. So there are times I'll complain about them, make fun of them.
Yep.
You know, and I think a lot of people kind of don't do that stuff. You know, they have a special category where, you know, maybe they're overprotective or feel awkward about it, but I've been around the group home for 40 years, and you know, we just try to be ourselves.
And you treat yourself that way in these poetry, this poetry too. You are sometimes a little bit brutal on yourself.
Yeah, it seems like it would be only fair. I mean, I'm probably not, you know, I'll try not to hold back on much.
Right.
So, and I think it'll allow a reader to trust my work better.
I would think so, because there's certainly an honesty that comes through your poetry, but I'm not sure where it comes from. It comes from, we've talked, and that's helped a lot. But it's there in the poetry, and I think it's just the skills you have as a poet of putting that across.
I mean, you know, as you were talking about it as a diary, I believe probably all of the poems have started with some degree that has happened or something I thought about. But there are certain things, you know, there are plenty of things in the poems that I'm not staying to the actual fact.
You're right.
You know, I am trying to make it as good of a poem as I think I can.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I want them to, like you said, feel like they're honest and true, even if some of the facts just don't meet up to really what happened.
Is there anything that's off limits in your poetry? Is there anything that you would not ever write about? I know that's a tough question, but you can just answer it yes or no. You don't have to get into specifics.
No, I would think there are a couple of things that I would be protective of anybody.
Okay.
Maybe more so with Jesse and the guys at work.
That's right. And I wanted to ask you about that. So have you ever gotten any blowback from either Jesse or the other residents of the home that they are included in your poetry? I mean, are people sometimes get incensed, like their caretakers too, or what?
I've never had a problem with that.
Okay.
And, you know, the people I'm writing about really, you know, don't read on that level.
Right.
And wouldn't even see it and be aware of it.
But what about, do they have family too or not? Or mostly they're just there by themselves?
A couple do have family.
Yeah.
And one mom would probably be happier if I didn't write about.
Okay.
And in those cases, I'll change names and things like that.
Now, you should explain who Jesse is for people who can't remember from the last interview.
He's the son of an ex-girlfriend, and I've known him since he was 5, and me and his mom were together maybe 2 years and lived together a half a year. And he's 25 now.
Wow.
And, you know, we're still connected. Before the virus, I would visit him once a month and spend the weekend with him.
Where did that bond form? Because throughout your poetry, I mean, Jesse crops up a lot. And the bond there is amazing. Talk to me about the evolution of that. Like, he's autistic.
Yes.
But is he fairly functional autistic?
It's hard to describe and put it in that terms.
Yeah.
Like, there are definitely things he can do really well.
Uh-huh.
But his communication skills aren't great. So, you know, it's kind of a mix. You know, I can't even say, like, you know, they'll sometimes say people behave or have the knowledge of a 5, 6, 10-year-old. Like, his skills are scattered.
Wow.
Some are better than others.
Is your bond deeper with him on some levels than with other people that you just know around you?
think that has happened.
Yeah.
With both him and the guy who lived at the residence, I felt closest to Larry.
Oh, yeah. And it's weird to think, you know, I say, yeah, excitedly, because I feel like I know a part of the, or a piece of these guys.
Yeah. I mean, there are things in their personality that, you know, I love in everybody, you know.
Yeah.
The things that I dislike in people, they don't have. So that makes it easy. And in Jesse's case, when me and his mom moved in together, you know, I wasn't going to move in with her unless I was seeing him as if he was my son.
Right.
And you know, I liked him instantly. Huh. I can't say when I first heard about him that I said, oh, great, my girlfriend has a, you know, a son. That wasn't something that I was really looking for.
No, that's usually a deal breaker for a lot of guys.
I mean, you know, I liked him right away. Also, because of my job, I kind of knew what his, you know, how his life would develop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of these guys really don't have people who are friends. You know, the people that are around them tend to be family or people who are getting paid to be around them.
That's right. That's right.
And, you know, I definitely will do what I can for Jesse to make his life better. I mean,
that's interesting.
You know, it's like a given now.
It's such a unique relationship. I mean, it's when I read the poems about it, I mean, it's just, it's so heartfelt, but it's also so interesting. And it's none of that, it's long distance. I mean, is he still in the Pacific Northwest?
Yes.
So you're a New York guy. So
yeah, yeah.
That's a long distance to do. How's he doing with not seeing you because of COVID?
It's weird and it's hard to figure out.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there are times when I'm not with him, and if it's an extended period, and also there were extended periods because of my health issues.
Oh, yeah.
And I would always wonder, you know, like when I'm there, he's definitely with me, wants me to be there. But when I'm not there, I don't know if he, like, thinks about me. You know, we've tried to do FaceTime, but it's not something he's really interested in.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll get a minute and a half. And in that minute and a half, he'll give me a date to come, and I'll say yes.
and then I'll make
reservations. And unfortunately, I have to been having to cancel them because of the COVID.
Oh, man. Wow.
He feels like he settled with it as soon as he gets another date to see me.
Right. So he has to have that date that he can count on. And then if
it seems like it.
Like, yeah, the important thing is to have that date, that specific date to look forward to. Even if it gets canceled, as long as he has another date after that, then that's okay.
I mean, that's what it appears like, but because he can't tell me.
That's right. That's right.
You know, I'm just going on what I'm getting from what he displays, and sometimes it's not a lot, and I can never be sure I'm right or wrong.
Wow. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight, it's always a pleasure talking to him, is poet Tony Glegler. And we're talking about his collection. Actually, he sent me this collection. It's the one that came out before the latest one. What Kind of Man is the newest collection, but we're talking about Until the Last Light Leaves. I love that title. Can I ask you to read a poem from there?
Sure. And I'll read the poem where the title came from.
Yeah.
And it's called Goodbye. Today, I picked Jesse up from music group. He said my name as soon as I stepped through the door, tried to run to me. The therapist stood in his way, forced him to stay until he made eye contact, said goodbye to her assistant, the other kids. She slowly walked him over to me, assured me how much better he was doing while he tugged on my arm, repeating home louder and louder. I thanked her while we headed out the door, tried to keep him from jumping into every puddle, steer him from bumping into people as we turned down subway stairs. Jesse took a window seat, got on his knees, and traced the outline of his face as we rode. I finger counted the 6 stops to Hamilton Parkway, promised that his mom would be waiting for him. When the train rose out of the ground, climbed up into the cloudless sky, he ran to the front door. I stood behind him, played with his hair as all of Red Hook spread beneath us.
Wow.
I glanced at the other riders, curious whether they could tell something was off with Jesse, then wondered what he was thinking, if his brain could hold anything other than shapes and colors flying past, the feel of glass against his fingertips, the thought that his mommy would be waiting 3, now 2 stations away. I imagined what he would do if we stayed on longer, rode to Coney Island. Would he stop crying and fighting long enough to see or hear, smell the ocean? Would he run across the sand like the summer before, stripped down to his shorts, jump and play in the waves until the last light leaves the sky? The closets are empty and piles of packed boxes line the walls of his house. But I'm not sure Jesse knows that this means he's moving back to Maine in the morning. I don't know if he can grasp the concept of missing someone or understand how hard it is for me to keep from crying. He has no idea that I met him 3 years ago. I went with Helen to pick him up from school one afternoon. The Sunday after, I finished with my bowl of oatmeal. I was watching her lift her teacup to her lips when I realized I wanted to spend my life with her, and it scared me to death. I don't know what Jesse remembers about Maine, about moving to Brooklyn, if he knows when things started to fall apart, or why me and his mom couldn't find a way to stay together. If he remembers that I moved down the block, kept visiting him, while everyone I know told me to let go and move on, that I didn't owe him a thing, and no one seemed to accept or understand. I love Jesse, that the way he will never fit in the world reminds me of me, and I wish he was my son, my 8-year-old boy, mine.
As I was listening to that, and it's always a different experience having the poet read the poem versus you reading the poem and it's all in your head, because you read it at a different pace and you read it in a different way. And when you're hearing it linearly. But your work, your poems are so cinematic. And it just struck me that, you know, I was running the film of that whole poem in my head while you were reading it. Have you seen that in your poetry before, the sort of cinematic layout of it? I'm not sure what I'm quite getting at here, but they really conjure images when the listener hears them.
Well, I know I'm trying to make people see things exactly the way I see them.
Yeah. But there's a lot of very tactile images and parts of your poem, but then there's all the internal stuff too, and it's really like a really interesting independent movie. when I listen to it, it's just very powerful, and it has a flow to it that's very cinematic. It's just, I want to ask you and talk to me about the evolution of your poetry. You started writing poetry when you were a kid.
You know, in my late teens. You know, I think
did you write the typical poems that every teen writes?
Oh, yeah, only they were probably worse than everybody else's. Yeah.
Do you know what? When I ask that of other poets, every poet says that same thing. Because
yeah,
every poet's very embarrassed of their original poetry.
Yeah, no, it took a while to not be afraid to show it to anybody. I mean, I wrote about trying to change the world. you know, meeting the perfect girl, and, you know, and also like rhyming the damn thing.
So you're writing rock songs?
Yeah, of course. I mean, if I could write rock songs, I wouldn't be writing poetry, but I can't.
So you're writing bad rock songs?
Well, you know, I needed the music.
And that's always the hard part. How do you get better? You know, it's always a mystery to me when I talk to accomplished poets. Is it just a long slog of feedback and working it out and rewriting, or what?
I know that I took a bunch of workshops.
Were they helpful?
Yes, a couple of them were like super helpful. And some of it was just about the fact that what I was writing could be poetry. Because I'm such a narrative poet, there were, you know, I've had teachers who have asked, you know, why don't you write short stories? And I think my stuff seems like it would fit in that, but I always felt drawn to line breaks,
yep,
poetry, and the first teacher that really was important to me was a guy named William Packard. And, you know, he kind of like just said, okay, yeah, you can do this and you can get good at it. And he taught me about cutting and being, you know, precise and trying not to waste words and learning how to cut. And then after that, I was reading other poets, trying to find out different things I would want to do. I do remember when I first started out that my poems would be shorter and kind of like one-dimensional,
mm-hmm,
going towards like one point that I couldn't handle too much in a poem. And as I kept writing, I learned how to like switch times, move back and forth in time, have more than one person in the poem.
Huh.
And, you know, I'm not exactly sure the step-by-step, but, you know, I wrote a lot. There were things I could tell that I liked better than others. There were some things teachers told me that I knew wasn't for me.
What were the first poets that you were attracted to that you feel that gave you something that you could use?
Really early, it was Anne Sexton.
Oh, I met her. Do you know, I'm old enough, I met her. It was actually, it was just months before she killed herself. She was at a book fair in Boston, and I got a signed copy of her latest collection of books.
Oh, cool.
But she scares the crap out of me. Her poems are like amazing.
Yeah, no, they knock me out.
Yeah.
And then later, some of Richard Hugo.
Yep.
And a little later, Philip Levine.
Oh, yeah. You know, just talking, do you think we teach poetry to younger people all wrong, like on the high school level? Like, you know, we teach all the, you know, Byron and all the big poems, and you have to memorize a certain thing. And for most high school students, I think they develop a certain dread or whatever. They just don't want to deal with poetry after they take a poetry class.
No, I completely agree with you, and I have no use for those people. You know, I'm never going to read them. And, you know, I don't care how good they're supposed to be. And, you know, some of it was just, you know, I'm going to sound like a 13-year-old kid.
Cool.
But it's what's relevant to me. You know, I'm sorry. I think, you know, I probably started with, you know, Dylan, Springsteen, Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when I liked that enough, then I started going towards poetry.
That's really interesting. I think on the high school level, I don't think we do enough with teaching really good and maybe controversial contemporary and modern poets. Like you mentioned Anne Sexton. I can't imagine that showing up in any high school poetry class.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I went to Catholic schools. And
oh, you
know,
wow.
Poetry was never big, so.
Not in the service of the Lord, no.
No, no, and, you know, I really don't know what was taught. just the few poets or poems that I read.
That were approved by the church.
Yeah, or just were like part of the canon, and I just...
Oh my God. I'm amazed you escaped relatively clean from those experiences.
Well, I do have to say, I really had a good time in grammar school and Catholic school, but I hated the high school.
Were you one of those wise-ass kids?
I was pretty quiet. And
okay.
I was, in the early years, really interested in getting good marks. And
okay. That was like me. Yeah, I didn't go to a Catholic school. I went to a... But I lived in a neighborhood with... I was the only one who didn't go to a Catholic school. So there was like all these kids around me, and they all went to different Catholic schools outside of Boston. And it really affected the way I saw kids at that point. All the girls played nuns when I was a kid.
Okay, well, it took me a while to get to know girls.
Yeah.
So by the time I knew them, if they were ever playing nuns, they had stopped. So, okay.
Well, one was living right across from me. And man, it was just incredible. They've all, you know, put sheets over their heads and give each other communion. And I was just sitting there like, you know, where am I? I felt like it was in the middle of a cult or something. It was bizarre.
Yeah, no, as I got older, yeah, I really didn't like high school, you know, in a Catholic high school. And I felt that they taught everything all wrong, and that we were even separated. One wing was boys.
Oh, wow.
Wing
wow.
Girls.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I just felt it got in the way of me, like, becoming somewhat normal.
We literally have 1 minute left. Because we get off talking, and it's like we're going to have to continue the conversation again. Do you consider, and this has got to be obviously true, the New York City has a really vibrant, vital poetry scene. That it's really alive. I know that I've talked to poets in L.A. The L.A. scene is really great. The Pacific Northwest has a whole group of poems, too. And I just have to believe that New York City, is it very supportive?
I was part of it in some ways when I was much younger.
Yeah.
But as I've gotten older and older, I really write on my own and only go see things when there are people I know
Got
that
it.
I like are there. So I've kind of faded away from that. I did go to L.A. a couple of times for the last two books.
Yeah.
And they were much more supportive than I thought. I mean, I was selling books.
So New York lives up to its old history. That's great. It's still a tough town.
It was just, I mean, also...
We're completely out of time. We've gone run over. My returning guest tonight is poet Tony Glegler. And we've been talking about his collection Until the Last Light Leaves. He's going to be back. He will be back. Tony, it's been a pleasure as always.
No, same thing here. I had a really good time.
Yeah, me too. It's just like we start talking and the show's over. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.